File 19. One truth which must always be borne in mind is that the majority can never replace the man. The majority represents not only ignorance, but also cowardice. And just as 100 blockheads do not equal one man of wisdom, so 100 poltroons are incapable of any political line of action that requires moral strength and fortitude. The lighter the burden of responsibility on each individual leader, the greater will be the number of those who, in spite of their sorry mediocrity, will feel the call to place their immortal energies at the disposal of the nation. They are so much on the tiptoe of expectation that they find it hard to wait their turn. They stand in a long queue, painfully and sadly counting the number of those ahead of them and calculating the hours until they may eventually come forward. They watch every change that takes place in the personnel of the office towards which their hopes are directed, and they are grateful for every scandal which removes one of the aspirants waiting ahead of them in the queue. If somebody sticks too long to his office stool, they consider this almost as a breach of a sacred understanding based on their mutual solidarity. They grow furious and give no peace until that inconsiderate person is finally driven out and forced to hand over his cozy berth for public disposal. After that, he will have little chance of getting another opportunity. Usually, those placemen who have been forced to give up their posts push themselves again into the waiting queue, unless they are hounded away by the protestations of the other aspirants. The result of all this is that, in such a state, the succession of sudden changes in public positions and public offices has a very disquieting effect in general, which may easily lead to disaster when an adverse crisis arises. It is not only the ignorant and the incompetent person who may fall victim to those parliamentary conditions, for the genuine leader may be affected just as much as the others, if not more so, whenever fate has chanced to place a capable man in the position of leader. Let the superior quality of such a leader be once recognized, and the result will be that a joint front will be organized against him, particularly if that leader, though not coming from their ranks, should fall into the habit of intermingling with these illustrious nincompoops on their own level. They want to have only their own company, and will quickly take a hostile attitude towards any man who might show himself obviously above and beyond them when he mingles in their ranks. Their instinct, which is so blind in other directions, is very sharp in this particular. The inevitable result is that the intellectual level of the ruling class sinks steadily. One can easily forecast how much the nation and the state are bound to suffer from such a condition of affairs, provided one does not belong to that same class of leaders. The parliamentary regime in the old Austria was the very archetype of the institution as I have described it. Though the Austrian Prime Minister was appointed by the King Emperor, this act of appointment merely gave practical effect to the will of the Parliament. The huckstering and bargaining that went on in regard to every ministerial position showed all the typical marks of the Western democracy. The results that followed were in keeping with the principles applied. The intervals between the replacement of one person by another gradually became shorter, finally ending up in a wild relay chase. With each change, the quality of the statesman in question deteriorated, until finally only the petty type of political huckster remained. In such people, the qualities of statesmanship were measured and valued according to the adroitness with which they pieced together one coalition after another. In other words, their craftiness in manipulating the pettiest political transactions, which is the only kind of practical activity suited to the aptitudes of these representatives. In this sphere, Vienna was the school which offered the most impressive examples. Another feature that engaged my attention quite as much as the features I have already spoken of was the contrast between the talents and knowledge of these representatives of the people, on the one hand, and, on the other, the nature of the tasks they had to face. Willingly or unwillingly, one could not help thinking seriously of the narrow intellectual outlook of these chosen representatives of the various constituent nationalities, and one could not avoid pondering on the methods through which these noble figures in our public life were first discovered. It was worthwhile to make a thorough study and examination of the way in which the real talents of these gentlemen were devoted to the service of their country. In other words, to analyze thoroughly the technical procedure of these activities. The whole spectacle of parliamentary life became more and more desolate the more one penetrated into its intimate structure and studied the persons and principles of the system in a spirit of ruthless objectivity. Indeed, it is very necessary to be strictly objective in the study of the institution whose sponsors talk of objectivity in every other sentence as the only fair basis of examination and judgment. If one studied these gentlemen and the laws of their strenuous existence, the results were surprising. There is no other principle which turns out to be quite so ill-conceived as the parliamentary principle, if we examine it objectively. In our examination of it, we may pass over the methods according to which the election of the representatives takes place, as well as the ways which bring them into office and bestow new titles on them. It is quite evident that only to a tiny degree are public wishes or public necessities satisfied by the manner in which an election takes place. For everybody who properly estimates the political intelligence of the masses can easily see that this is not sufficiently developed to enable them to form general political judgments on their own account, or to select the men who might be competent to carry out their ideas in practice. Whatever definition we may give of the term public opinion, only a very small part of it originates from personal experience or individual insight. The greater portion of it results from the manner in which public matters have been presented to the people through an overwhelmingly impressive and persistent system of information. In the religious sphere, the profession of a denominational belief is largely the result of education, while the religious yearning itself slumbers in the soul. So too, the political opinions of the masses are the final result of influences systematically operating on human sentiment and intelligence, in virtue of a method which is applied sometimes with almost incredible thoroughness and perseverance. By far the most effective branch of political education, which in this connection is best expressed by the word propaganda, is carried on by the press. The press is the chief means employed in the process of political enlightenment. It represents a kind of school for adults. This educational activity, however, is not in the hands of the state, but in the clutches of powers which are partly of a very inferior character. While still a young man in Vienna, I had excellent opportunities for coming to know the men who own this machine for mass instruction, as well as those who supplied it with the ideas it distributed. At first, I was quite surprised when I realized how little time was necessary for this dangerous great power within the state to produce a certain belief among the public. And in doing so, the genuine will and convictions of the public were often completely misconstrued. It took the press only a few days to transform some ridiculously trivial matter into an issue of national importance, while vital problems were completely ignored or filched and hidden away from public attention. The press succeeded in the magical art of producing names from nowhere within the course of a few weeks. They made it appear that the great hopes of the masses were bound up with those names, and so they made those names more popular than any man of real ability could ever hope to be in a long lifetime. All this was done despite the fact that such names were utterly unknown, and indeed had never been heard of, even up to a month before the press publicly emblazoned them. At the same time, old and tried figures in the political and other spheres of life quickly faded from the public memory and were forgotten as if they were dead, though still healthy and in the enjoyment of their full vigour. Or sometimes such men were so vilely abused that it looked as if their names would soon stand as permanent symbols of the worst kind of baseness. In order to estimate properly the really pernicious influence which the press can exercise, one has to study this infamous Jewish method, whereby honourable and decent people were besmirched with mud and filth in the form of low abuse and slander from hundreds and hundreds of quarters simultaneously, as if they commanded some magic formula. These highway robbers would grab at anything which might serve their evil ends. They would poke their noses into the most intimate family affairs, and would not rest until they had sniffed out some petty item which could be used to destroy the reputation of their victim. But if the result of all this sniffing should be that nothing derogatory was discovered in the private or public life of the victim, they continued to hurl abuse at him in the belief that some of their animadversions would stick, even though refuted 1,000 times. In most cases, it finally turned out impossible for the victim to continue his defence, because the accuser worked together with so many accomplices that his slanders were re-echoed interminably. But these slanderers would never own that they were acting from motives which influenced the common run of humanity, or are understood by them. Oh no! The scoundrel who defamed his contemporaries in this villainous way would crown himself with a halo of heroic probity fashioned of unctuous phraseology and twaddle about his duties as a journalist and other mouldy nonsense of that kind. When these cattlefishes gathered together in large shoals at meetings and congresses, they would give out a lot of slimy talk about a special kind of honour, which they called the professional honour of the journalist. Then the assembled species would bow their respects to one another. These are the kind of beings that fabricate more than two-thirds of what is called public opinion, from the foam of which the parliamentary Aphrodite eventually arises.